This is a Triple J podcast.
Hey, it's Dave Marchese. This is the Hack Podcast. Pretty straightforward, isn't it? Every time we've talked about uni placements, the overwhelming response is just pay us, pay students. We can't afford to live while doing this compulsory prac. Who is going to pay for it, though? That's the question. Is it the employers? Is it the government? Later, we're going to get into this, back into placement chat, because a group of experts has got together to try to figure out how to solve this, and we're going to hear about their plan soon. Also, with the Splendour cancellation still reverberating through the music industry, people are out there warning, you know, is this the end of festivals? I'm interested to hear what people in the industry who put on festivals think. Other people, like the promoters who put on Splendour. Chat with another big one in Australia about what he reckons of this whole situation. First, though,
Hack.
The incidents that we saw over the last day or so, that was truly the final straw for this community.
On Triple J.
Yeah, for years, youth crime has been impacting communities across Australia. In Alice Springs, it's been in the headlines for years. You might remember the Prime Minister flew in last year. It became a big political issue as well. Some locals feel like they're at their wits' end and they're tired of feeling unsafe. And then there are others who say systems are failing young people, governments are doing nowhere near enough to address the root causes of the violence. It's all come to a head this week. Violent, chaotic scenes broke out across Alice Springs CBD. The NT government put a curfew in place, and our under 18s aren't allowed out at night. To fill us in on what's happened, because there's been quite a bit, and how the community feels about it, here's Angel Parsons.
On Tuesday afternoon in Alice Springs, unrest and violence really escalated.
Mate, they're taking 20-metre jumps and jumping in the glass trying to smash it.
Including this attack on a pub.
Oh, she's got a brick!
It's escalated big time. They've smashed your one door already.
Up to 150 people were reportedly rioting through town. Police seized 50 weapons and arrested 5 people. Police say some of the violence was related to the death of an 18-year-old man in a car crash earlier this month.
That's led to family feuds, and that's what erupted in Alice Springs.
But after years of growing unrest related to youth crime, the latest incidents triggered calls from some politicians who want the federal government to step in and do something about it, including the local mayor.
You know, we thought it was bad a year ago. That was way worse than a year ago.
The federal opposition spokesperson for Indigenous Australians, Senator Jacinta Numpaginpa-Price, even wants the Defence Force brought into town.
To make the people of Alice Springs feel some sense of safety once and for all.
And so this was the Northern Territory government's answer, announced yesterday.
My government will declare an emergency situation in Alice Springs. That means police will have the power to enforce a curfew in the Alice Springs CBD for people who are 18 years and younger.
As of last night, under 18s have a curfew. If they're caught in town between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m, police can take them home or to another safe place. The curfew will last for 2 weeks, covering the school holidays, and will be extended if the government deems it to be effective. Here's Chief Minister Eva Lawler today.
It was a quiet night for young people in Alice Springs, and that's what Alice Springs people want to see.
Extra police have been sent into the town to enforce the curfew.
The curfew is but one measure. There will continue to be a range of complex issues.
Some feel that this was necessary.
This is a 14-day reprieve for the community.
And I think it's been long overdue now that we start building some sort of relations in regards to working with police and with community for community safety.
But some young people say they're disappointed and really don't rate the government's communication with them.
It's really unfair. Not a lot of Aboriginal young people in Alice have licence. We can't really show you that we are of age or 18, so how do they determine that? Also, we're not sure if it's all youth. Is it just Aboriginal youth? Is it white youth, multicultural youth? They're not really clarifying who's actually intended on this curfew.
Alice Springs youth worker Amani Francois is 18. She says people are confused and they're there's so much mistrust and hurt already in the community.
We're not going to trust the police, especially with the inquest that happened last month. You know, like, we're feeling a great amount of fear, and it's only inflicting nothing but terror for the streets, especially in the CBD of Alice Springs.
The federal MP for Lingiari, Marion Scrimgeour, reckons the curfew will help, but there can't be knee-jerk responses.
It's time for all sides to stop playing politics with this issue. It's too important.
Others have grim predictions about the curfew. This is June Oscar from the Australian Human Rights Commission.
Often these measures will disproportionately affect First Nations people, and they always do. And sadly, this is another example of a punitive approach imposed from the top and outside, and is destined to fail because the solutions do not have the involvement of the community.
Hack on Triple J.
Angel Parsons with that update. I want to get into this more with someone who's looked quite a bit at curfews in the past, not just in Australia but overseas. Had a big look at the research internationally. Terry Goldsworthy is a criminologist at Bond University. He's also a former Queensland detective. He's with us now. Terry, thank you very much for coming on Hack. At face value, what do you make of this move to put a curfew in place in Alice Springs?
You know, I accept it as a short-term measure. I think there were some issues there in the last 48 hours that the police lost control of certain areas of the town, and they needed to do something to regain that. Whether this will be an effective long-term strategy will be another matter. I don't know what will happen at the end of the 14 days, but the police have surged in 60 extra officers there. How long they can sustain that is also another question. But there's got to be some long-term outcomes looked at as to how they address these antisocial behaviours. You know, a 14-day period's not going to resolve it.
I mean, you've looked into curfews in the past, what the research has told us. What does the evidence say about curfews in general?
Yeah, look, it's a bit mixed. There's some metadata analysis done over the US that says that they were effective in reducing crime. And then there's other ones that say that they're ineffective in terms of reducing crime or youth issues, et cetera. There was a curfew over in Northbridge in WA, commenced in 2003. And, you know, there was an analysis done of that in 2017 that said it wasn't effective, that even though the crime had initially reduced after the curfew, it also reduced in other areas around in Perth where there was no curfew. So I think curfews for youths are problematic in terms of how they're going to be enforced, how difficult is the area to police. Like, there's a fairly small area in terms of Alice Springs that they've declared the high-risk area. And it is surrounded, I was looking at the map before, it is surrounded by other suburban areas. So will the problems move or be displaced in those areas would be a question worth considering.
What approaches do work in addressing youth crime? Like, in like your research, have you found like some areas that are particularly useful, or is it, you know, just quite different in Alice Springs that different approaches need to be taken?
Yeah, I think Alice Springs is probably different in its dynamics to say, well, I'm on the Gold Coast, how you might respond to youth crime on the Gold Coast here. Generally, in terms of youth crime, you can look at a couple of issues, and they are generally divided into pre-crime, the crime itself, and post-crime. You know, we know that youth crime is multifactorial. There's a whole range of causations and effects that are causing the crime. We had some data come out in Queensland quite recently that tells us in 2003, for instance, 70% of our youth offenders reoffended within 12 months. You know, looking at the complexity of those young offenders, 81% had used at least one substance. 38% of them had used amphetamine. You know, other challenges they have are, you know, a lack of engagement with education. You know, about 50% hadn't engaged in training or education. They're exposed to domestic violence in the home. And, you know, about 48% of those offenders, 44% had some kind of mental health or behavioural disorder that was either diagnosed or suspected. So all of those things are your pre-crime issues that if you could address may well stop your crime happening. If that's not being done, then we have the crime issue. And that's where I think you see things like the curfew come in that are designed to ensure community safety. I mean, well, I think most of us have seen the footage now where we had people besieged in a hotel there in broad daylight. You just can't have things like that going on. And then once you move on from that, then you have to look at what happens post-crime, where you have these offenders, and particularly serious repeat offenders, and in Queensland we actually classify them now on an evidence base and have a court declaration to that effect. Figures we got last week indicate we've got about 482 serious repeat offenders in Queensland as of December last year. So those are the offenders that it's all gone well to build extra detention centres as we're doing, and we'll have a new one open at the end of this year with an extra 70 beds. But while they may be sentenced to a period of detention, you need to ensure that there's good rehabilitation programs engaging them in there, and also when they get out, so they just don't fall back into that cycle of reoffending.
This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Dr. Terry Goldsworthy, a former police officer, detective, now an associate professor in criminology at Bond University. We're talking about curfews generally and youth crime, strategies that have worked in the past, others which maybe haven't, and what the research tells us. We've heard from some, including June Oscar from the Human Rights Commission, an Indigenous rights advocate, who's said that this approach in Alice Springs is punitive, it's destined to fail. What do you make of those comments?
Yeah, look, when you're looking at curfews, it's always the issue of how are they going to measure success? What parameters are they putting in there to say this is the success? So, you know, I guess, is it the stopping of crime in the short term? Do they see that as a success? I suspect they would there at the moment. You know, what you should be looking for, I guess, in terms of success is long-term reduction of crime. You know, that's problematic when you've only got a 14-day strategy. I mean, this is designed simply to make the streets safe again. How long that will last after the curfew finishes, if it is put off, will be anyone's guess. How long they can surge an extra 60 police in there is another question in terms of resourcing. Is it punitive? Well, it may well be. I mean, you may be capturing 18-year-olds under the age of 18 who aren't necessarily out there engaging in crime, et cetera. But, you know, I guess when you've got these kind of circumstances, it can come problematic in terms of targeting groups. And that's why I think, you know, if you're going to have curfews, my recommendation was that you use targeted curfews if you're going to use them. So you identify your offenders, you place them on a curfew, and you target them with resourcing. So that means you go around and perform a check, make sure they're adhering to the curfew. And if they're not, then you take the relevant action against them.
I'm interested in your take, Terry, as a criminologist, but also someone who is a former detective who has worked, you know, within police. Do you think there's a big issue of young people not trusting the police? And do you think police need to be doing more to get on top of that and to addressing that?
Yeah, look, there should be a couple of aspects to any policing response. One would be the community partnership policing that you would be seeking to establish out there. And that is getting, you know, young people to take notice of their own elders, et cetera, getting them to come in and try and control some lawful behaviours that are going on. And then you have, on the other hand, you probably describe it as punitive, but the enforcement actions by the police where they will arrest and criminally charge people. Both of those things have a role to play, you know, the community policing aspect as well as the pure enforcement operational aspect of policing. The problem is, you know, if you're going to engage in that community policing, you really also need other government organisations, even non-government organisations, to probably be with you as the police move in to do that, to address those complex causation factors that I outlined before. You know, the police aren't there to deal with someone who's got an addiction issue in terms of methamphetamine or ice or something. That's where you need a health response to be there with the police to assist in engaging that community policing.
Dr. Terry Goldsworthy from Bond University, appreciate you coming on Hack.
Thanks for that.
Hack.
Everything for it just to all get cancelled, like, you know, in the blink of an eye is terrifying.
Something catastrophic is going on when you've got Splendor Falls, Groove in the Moo, Vintage Vibes, Dark Mofa, all taking a year off to calibrate.
What does the future of festivals look like?
On Triple J.
Are music festivals dead in Australia? It's the question everyone's been asking today after Splendor's cancellation. Shocked a lot of people. Australia's biggest, most iconic music festival cancelled in 2024 due to what organisers called unexpected events. The fallout has been huge. So much coverage of this on the news, you can imagine. Was there enough government support? Politicians in federal parliament saying, no, there wasn't. The New South Wales Premier didn't agree with that. Here's what Chris Minns had to say earlier today.
Unfortunately, what was
discussed or effectively offered by the government wasn't accepted by the organisers, which is a real shame because that's an institution. But I can promise you that the Minister, John Graham, did make contact. We did try to save that festival, but what we were offering obviously wasn't enough.
Artists are weighing in. I saw a tweet from one musician saying music culture in Australia is dead, that this isn't just about the cost of living. It's because people just don't want to support musicians. They say they're happy to fork out for international acts like Taylor or Fred again. What do you think? Do you reckon there's a real issue with music culture in Australia? Do you think the festival era is done? It's over. Message in 0439757555. If you're someone that goes to a lot of festivals, I'm really keen to hear your thoughts on this one. If your view has changed over the last couple of years specifically, let's ask some of these questions now to Phil Palermo. He's the co-founder and director of Untitled Group, which puts on festivals like Beyond the Valley. And he's got a real understanding of this industry and what's happening. He's with us now. Hey, Phil, thank you very much for coming on Hack.
No worries, Dave.
People are out there saying the festival era is over after Splendour's cancellation. You're someone in the industry. You put on festivals. Could that be true?
It's absolutely devastating as the news is, as much as everyone's feeling for the team at Splendour in the Grass right now, including myself. There will always be a demand for festivals. It's part of the Australian culture, and I just think that will always exist. I mean, entertainment is something people require in good times, bad times. It's always going to be there. I think the future holds more expectations around increasing brand equity through experience.
Do you reckon it's a particular type of festival then, like a multi-genre festival experience that just isn't hitting with young people anymore? Like, you know, having a drill artist next to a pop artist next to someone who's, you know, doing electronic music.
I wouldn't say I agree with that. I think we're finding now more than ever, it has to be lineup and experience. It can't just be lineup. And it's an exciting challenge brainstorming such ideas and experiences at our own festivals. And we know a lot of other festivals, including Splendour in the Grass. Like, I can't tell you how many times I've gone to that festival and had like the most epic time ever.
I mean, there are people out there who say, look, festivals just need to book better lineups and then people are going to come. As a promoter, what do you say to that?
It's not as easy as that sounds. especially coming all the way to Australia with the internationals. I mean, distance plays a large role. We're really far away. The rising costs, I mean, inflation is going through the roof for these artists to put on these shows, both production, flights, you know, and that kind of ends up on the bottom line in terms of our lineup budget. So it's really important to not be totally reliant on lineups, I feel. And yeah, just responsible with the talent budgets, no matter how many people might either love it or might complain about some lineups, you know.
The kind of pressures that Splendour was experiencing, is Untitled having the same issues with some of those things?
We're all experiencing similar challenges. I mean, one of the biggest pressures we're currently facing is that music festivals, you know, we employ thousands of sole traders, small businesses, ABN holders. As a result of Splendour's cancellation, they're now missing out on another critical paycheck throughout the year. You know, some of the economic risks around the increase in conversation on music festivals cancelling can push more and more contractors to other industries. Construction is a good example. I guess this means not just for Untitled, but the whole industry, we're facing a supply shortage. Not to mention, like, on a personal note, these contractors basically become your family when you're working with them for 10 years plus. And it absolutely sucks to not see them back on site for bumping the following year.
This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Phil Palermo, who is from Untitled Group, I think Australia's biggest independent music promoter. Phil, do you have any kind of thoughts on what has happened with Splendour here, why it hasn't been successful?
Look, I'm not across the finer details as to why, so it probably wouldn't be appropriate for me to speak in detail on this. But all I can say is when a festival ends, no one wins. However, I do feel Splendour's handled the announcement, the process, their comms to artist teams. I mean, one of the artists that we represent is Hayden James, and I feel the way that they you know, notified us, and some of the terms and stuff are quite fair. We've always had lots of artists play at Splendor in the Grass before, but also to ticket holders to the best of their ability. I'm less concerned about why it ended this way this year. I'm just more hopeful that it returns next year stronger and better than ever. You know, there are a lot of great people behind Splendor in the Grass who have been working on the festival for so many years.
Do you reckon that'll happen, Phil? Like, do you actually have faith that Splendor will be back? Because people say Splendor represents something much bigger than just one festival. It's at the core of Australia's live music scene. Do you fully believe that it could come back again?
Yes, I do. I think the market is constantly shifting. Times change. I think this period that we're going through at the moment, you know, there's light at the end of the tunnel. And these festivals, you know, they bring a lot of income into these regions, raising money through community barbecues, community grants, sporting clubs. I mean, a lot of this money goes to local wildlife, rescue groups, local hospitals. These aren't just key values at our festivals, but others like Splendor in the Grass. So I'm also very hopeful that it comes back, because the amount of money that's injected into those key social, cultural and community groups as a part of the values is absolutely crucial.
Just finally, Phil, a parliamentary inquiry into live music in Australia was announced today. What do you think of that? Like, do you think more government funding, more support is needed?
Yeah, I think, look, Music Australia and the Australian Festival Association, for example, they are doing great work. They're collaborating with us and other promoters. You know, we welcome all government support, obviously, but they're, at the moment, I mean, their doors are open. They are listening. They are engaging. They see the value of festivals on culture. And yeah, we will continue to work with them on solutions. And I'm sure that there's a number of other promoters that are doing the same thing right now.
All right. Well, we appreciate your time. Thank you very much for speaking with us. Phil Palermo from Untitled Group, thanks for coming on Hack.
Thanks, Dave.
And probably not surprising, a lot of people want to weigh in on this. We have so many opinions flooding through. Someone says, I don't think that the music scene's dead in Australia at all. I go to gigs nearly every week to see local and international bands. I believe the tough thing with Splendor was a three-day event, rising costs. It makes people prioritise. Someone else, love festivals, love a gig. However, I'm not buying a week after the tickets come out, which isn't helpful for organisers, but I don't know if I want to go or not 6 months before. Someone else, not the end of festivals at all. Both Good Things and Knotfest sold out this year, maybe because they're a specific kind of niche, which is interesting. That was one of the questions I just put to Phil, but he thinks the multi-genre festivals still have a future. Someone else says, I've been to countless festivals around the world, including some of the biggest in the world, and I don't go to Australian ones anymore because of the crowds. Australian crowds are shocking at festivals, and a lot more antisocial than many other festival crowds across the globe. That's so interesting. Okay, people really firing off about that. Someone says Tassie festivals and the music scene in Tasmania is popping. Of course, we had Party in the Paddock. It was cancelled a few years ago, kind of around the COVID years, and then it came back because there was so much demand for it. And I guess people are hoping that is what happens with Splendor and some of those others that have decided they're going to take the year off, that they will be able to recalibrate and come back stronger. Hey, well, only time will tell. Got to move on, though.
Hack. They basically work for 6 months full-time unpaid.
On Triple J.
Telling people to work for free, obviously not a popular thing. Nobody wants to do that, except if you're volunteering your time because you want to. But a lot of people are doing this. They're working for nothing, doing placements. A lot of students, it's the reality of getting your qualifications. You've basically got two options. You try to battle through or you quit and you give up on your dream. Social work students have the most intense requirements for uni placements. They have 1,000 hours of unpaid work to get through their degree. Now a think tank has crunched the numbers and come up with what it thinks is the solution to that. Shalala Madora explains.
We hear a lot of stories of skipped meals, of housing insecurity, of homelessness, of loss of employment.
Isaac Wattenberg is part of a group called Students Against Placement Poverty. He's talking here about how hard unpaid placements are, specifically for social work students.
We need urgent relief now. We can't wait for this to be pushed down the line.
Placements for social work are next level. Students have to complete 1,000 hours of unpaid work to finish their degree. That's roughly 6 months. So a group of students, unions and academics came to Canberra to urge Polys to do something about it. Angus McFarland from the Australian Services Union was here too.
We know that only 50% of social workers complete their courses, and this is because of placement poverty.
Professor Wendy Bowles from Charles Sturt University says online distance students have the same requirements for placements, and that's leading to a huge number dropping out.
It's really hard for particularly rural students in small communities to find the diversity of placements that these degrees need. So it's really hard for them to travel to another place, particularly if they've got family or work responsibilities.
Professor Bowles says you can't leave the issues to universities alone to fix.
Quite a few universities offer specific scholarships, especially through if they've got, say, a rural health department for allied health students. But all of those scholarships are competitive and not everybody gets one.
So who should fix it if not the unis? That group I mentioned earlier of social work academics, student groups and unions, they commissioned a report looking into just this. They asked progressive think tank Per Capita to research options. Here's head of Per Capita, Emma Dawson.
We looked at everything from a welfare-style payment akin to a Centrelink payment. We looked at whether or not you should just end the legality of paid placements. That was a very bad idea. We looked at a full apprenticeship model.
The report says the best way to support students is to make the federal government pay for social work student placements, because the organisations that use the placements are often not-for-profits who say they can't afford to pay them themselves.
We came up with the model that would allow the government to create a regulation through the parliament to allow it to pay a stipend to the host organisations. It would be designed as a kind of wage subsidy, so there's precedent for that. And it would also ensure that those students who are predominantly women would receive superannuation.
But of course, that costs money.
Currently, we have about 7,000 students a year doing a placement of 500 hours. It's 1,000 in total, but they do 500 hours a year, and found that it would cost the government around $90 million, $91 million.
This issue of unpaid placements has been a problem for ages. In fact, it was addressed earlier this year in the Universities Accord, a report that called for a massive overhaul of the higher education system. The Accord recommended all placements be paid for by either governments or the private sector. It's fair to say Professor Wendy Bowles was excited to see that as a recommendation.
I was just jumping for joy because, you know, fourth year apprentices, engineering students, those male dominated occupations have had paid placements for many, many years. Occupations, professions like teaching, social work, nursing are female dominated. They've just been expected to do placements for free.
She's hoping the government puts some money towards fixing the issue in May's federal budget.
That gives the government the opportunity to invest so that we can meet all the job shortages, particularly in rural and regional Australia.
Emma Dawson acknowledges that that $91 million a year figure could actually go up as barriers to studying social work are removed and more students choose those courses. But she says it's worth it.
But we're also investing in the community because social workers go out and work with some of the most disadvantaged or vulnerable communities in the country. So it's an investment that will save us money down the track.
Hack on Triple J.
Shalala Medora there, and big response to this one. We've got messages coming through. Someone says, I'm a social worker, and those 6 months as unpaid work, especially through COVID, were absolutely brutal for finances and mental health. Someone else says, I dropped out of my social work degree last year only because I couldn't afford to do placement. I now have a big hex debt and no degree. Lots of thoughts as well on festivals and the future of festivals in the wake of the Splendour cancellation. Tish from NAMM says people want dance and DJ music at festivals and they want to see bands in a smaller venue. Post-COVID people just don't know festival or crowd etiquette. That's Tish's opinion. Another person says cost of food and beverages is a sting. Maybe encourage an all-inclusive deal with meal and drink vouchers. It's cheaper to go overseas for a week than go to a 3-day festival. And somebody else says, music festivals aren't dead. The musical genre is moving towards the house techno side as more mainstream, and the hard style festivals are at their peak. Look, we're going to keep hearing the thoughts of all of you, but also the industry as it goes through what is pretty intense time at the moment. There's no doubt about that. That is all we've got time for on the Hack Podcast for now. We'll be back on Tuesday next week. There's no Hack Podcast on Monday. I'll catch you then. See ya. Hack.